Thank you, Rabbi Ozarowski, and thank you all for coming. And somehow, although we have much in common, our where we want the microphone to be is somewhat different. So I'm going to see. I may just try the stooped-over approach, and I hope that you will be able to bear with me. Are we good? Thank God. Anyway, it's really great to be here. I want to thank Rabbi Ozarowski and also Rabbi Belinsky for being such wonderful hosts and so communicative throughout the entire process. This has been something I've been looking forward to for months. And of course, at some point, I had to ask the question, thank you for inviting me, but what am I going to tell a whole room of rabbis? So they thought of, there's an obscure little school within the Orthodox world, the Literary Theological School of Bible Scholarship, which I'm very much involved in. And it's a small little chunk of the pie, but I think it's a good one. And so they thought it would be a nice idea to share some of the underpinnings of it and then to turn it over to you to have some Q&A as well to make sure that we have a good dialogue about it. The logic of it is something along these lines. Spinoza changed the world. He really did. I don't know if it's changed the way that he was hoping it would change, but he changed the world dramatically. And for those of us in the world of Tanakh study, Bible study, he changed it permanently. He asked a series of questions and challenges that nobody publicly, at least, had the nerve to ask. And it changed the game. So, of course, the first reaction was, let's just shut the guy down, which might have had some devastating effects on his personal life, but the ideas didn't go away. He started saying, why don't we just try to read the Bible without coming in with a whole tote bag of assumptions, whatever religion you come from. For a long time, we Jews and Karaites and Christians could all agree that God revealed the entire Torah and that all of Scripture, the entire Tanakh, is, at least on some level, divine revealed truth. Spinoza said, well, where do you get that from? What do you see from within the text itself? Now, his conclusions were somewhat extreme, but that was a good question to ask, to start asking the question of what is the voice of Torah itself? We had a Pshat school, which goes far, far, far back, long before Spinoza, which attempted that to some degree. But there's also no question that it was so heavily influenced by rabbinic literature, by rabbinic tradition, that it was difficult for our commentators to genuinely look at the text and see it on its own terms. That's where it all comes from. So, for example, if you've ever read the Torah, and I imagine I'm in a room full of people where I can count on the fact that, yeah, you have, there are many contradictions. There always have been many contradictions, and Spinoza isn't the first one to figure that out. But for thousands of years, we rabbis had one approach to these contradictions, which was, since God revealed all of this, and since God knows how to make up his mind, the assumption is they're not really contradictions, right? So we had to fix them one by one. And we got really, really good at doing that, right? We would come up with harmonization. We would come up by saying, this verse is referring to A, and that verse is referring to B. The Gemara's language is hacha b'mayaskinan. What is each one dealing with? And that was good enough for us for a very, very long time. Spinoza, and in his wake, largely German Protestant Bible scholars in the 18th and 19th centuries, asked a question that we simply were not asking. And if we're not asking it, we ain't going to find any solutions to it. The questions that started coming up in the 18th and 19th centuries from the Protestant academic circles for the very first time was, okay, fine. We all know how to solve the contradictions. Good for us. But let's ask a different question today. Why are there so many contradictions in the first place? That's a very good question. And for some reason, we hadn't the foggiest clue of how to go about thinking about it because we never thought that way. Let's just ask systematically, why are there so many contradictions? Sure, we could try to show why they're not really contradictions, but God could have just written the Torah in a different way. That was a good question. Honestly, it was one of the better questions that they asked from that school. It changed our world. And then, by the end of the 19th century into the 20th, all kinds of archaeological finds, total blessings from a scholarly point of view. Mesopotamian texts, Ugaritic texts, Canaanite texts, Egyptian texts. And then scholars began to understand how to read them. And before you know it, there's a wealth of material from the ancient world in which the Torah and the rest of the Bible came from. Some of it long ways, much older than anything that the Torah is. Legal codes, mythologies, stories, practices, you name it. And funny enough, a lot of it is kind of similar to what's in the Torah. Not all of it. In fact, a lot of it, boy, oh boy, is it far into the Torah. But a lot of it is strikingly similar. For so many thousands of years, we were thinking about the Torah given at Sinai, at Mount Sinai, in a bubble. They were in a desert. God gave the Torah to the people of Israel. Nothing is really around them except for wicked pagans. And that's kind of how we thought about the Torah. And all of a sudden we start realizing there are high cultures with practices and laws, many of which almost are verbatim like what you find in the Torah. Well, these issues presented very monumental challenges that we simply never had to think about before. I like monumental challenges. I'm a happy guy. But for many in the Jewish and Christian worlds, this was not a happy situation. It led to a crisis because the critics came up with their conclusion in the 18th and 19th centuries. It must be that the Torah and the rest of the Bible were written by people and different schools of people in ancient Israel. It wasn't given by God. It was given by schools of people. And these people disagree with each other, and that's why there are contradictions. And they drew heavily from their ancient Near Eastern surroundings. It's not some Yesh Me'ayin. It's not some brand new creation, the Torah and the whole Bible. Rather, it came from an immediate context, surrounding context. And all of a sudden, the central underpinning, certainly for us Jews, but for Christians to a good degree also, God revealed the Torah, this is God's actual word, was under serious fire. And people studying in universities had to choose between faith and science. That's really what it came down to. Either you had to cling to your faith and ignore the evidence, or you had to pick up the evidence and say, okay, there goes the religion. Because after all, Judaism is quite the revealed religion. Take that away. You can still have lots of meaning. You can still have lots of observance. You could have lots of good things that come from the values of the Torah. But it's a different thing from what it was in 1600. So the rabbis came up with various solutions. I'm going to break them down into three buckets. And the reason why I care so much about this 19th century thing is because, honestly, I don't care about the 19th century at all. I care about now and how we live as Jews. But to understand these three buckets, help us understand how to go about confronting the world that we live in from a religious perspective. Whatever our particular slant of religious perspective is, we all care about using the Torah as a religious source to guide people through a very complicated time that we happen to live in. So I'm not speaking as a historian at all, even though you need to know the history to understand how to apply it. Many rabbis thought the best solution to all of this is to forbid any contact with that world at all. Don't go to university, and then you won't have this problem. Better yet, amazingly enough, it shocks me to this day, and shocks me to this day that there are still rabbis who say this, simply don't study Bible at all. Because then you won't have these questions. The best way to keep faith is to, ironically, cut our faith off at its heart. But all the same, this was a strategy that was employed by many rabbis in the 19th century to combat what was going on. They said the only way to keep our faith is to simply hide from the world that is around us. Good news was, people who hid retained their faith, more or less. Bad news is, that is such a failure of a solution. I don't need to tell anybody in this room how disastrous of the consequences that was for anybody who strayed one inch away from the little bubble that they were trying to create. They had zero tools, they had zero ability to confront challenges, and for the most part, simply abandoned the religion of their past. That was one strategy that many rabbis adopted. They simply didn't address the problem at all. A second group of rabbis thought the best solution was to battle the challenge. They said, look, there are some real questions that we need to address. Let's write commentaries to show why Jewish faith has it right and these guys have it wrong. Because after all, if we could show everybody that, then faith will win. And so they went into the trenches. They tried to show that the oral law is more closely affiliated with the written law than scholars were saying. That rabbinic Judaism is close to biblical Judaism rather than a lot of airtime between them. They tried to say that the contradictions, just like we did before this was a problem, they're not really such big contradictions. There's no reason whatsoever to get so fussy about it. These guys are overreading. We're reading it right. And a whole series of commentaries, very creative ones, came out in the 18th and 19th centuries where that was their strategy. Let's try to refute on scholarly grounds the arguments that the scholars are making. If we could show that they're wrong, well then, our people will remain faithful. That was strategy two. Strategy three, which I will put down my entire hand on the table, I think is the right one. So there you go. It's that of Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, and many others as well, who realized both of the first two approaches are simply failures. The first one fails because it ignores reality and it ignores scholarship. That's always bad from a Jewish point of view. The second one is a failed solution because you can't prove faith. You can't disprove it, but you can't prove it scientifically. Thank God we live in an age, Rambam and people thought that they could in the medieval period, and sometimes it might be hard for us to read their philosophy because they understand that they're trying to scientifically prove certain tenets of faith, whereas you and I living in a post-Kant world know, or I think we know, you can't do that. But once you're able to say we can't prove or disprove faith, let's benefit from the scholarly gains of the last 200 years. Seems like a no-brainer to me, but there was a huge firestorm of debate over this issue. In other words, a lot of the scholarship emerging from Protestant circles is good scholarship. We should be asking questions like, why are there so many contradictions in the Torah in the first place? That's a real issue that needs to be addressed. We should be paying attention to, oh, the Mesopotamians and Egyptians and Canaanites and all these other cultures around had cultures, had ideas, and some of those ideas are really similar to those that you find in the Bible. Why don't we talk about that instead of pretending that it doesn't exist? And his imagery is very beautiful. I have the first couple of sources here, just excerpts of his. If you've read Rav Kook, and you're like me, you don't understand a word that he ever says. He's so poetic, so flowery. So what I rely on are a couple of scholars who make what I hope are good translations of the sources, but they're people who I trust, who know something about Rav Kook. And then I take a couple of excerpts that I think capture the spirit of what's going on. In general, this is a great principle in the Battle of Ideas, he wrote in one of his letters, that for every view that appears to contradict some matter in the Torah, we must first not necessarily deny it. We shouldn't be going into the battle trenches every single time somebody says something different from what we believe. Settle down, he says. But rather build the palace of Torah over it. Torah is bigger than all of that. We shouldn't be threatened by questions. But rather, the Torah is infinite. God's word is infinite. Let's see how we can grow our palace ever stronger thanks to these ideas. We are thereby elevated by it. And it is for the sake of this elevation that these views are revealed. Afterwards, when we are not too troubled by anything, we are equipped with full confidence to confront that too. To me, this is the difference between strong faith and not such strong faith. Not such strong faith fears all questions. Strong faith says questions are our friends. If they're wrong, we can refute them. If there's some truth in there, or even if it just makes us rethink who we are, we're better people and better Jews as a consequence of that. That's what good learning is all about. So Rav Kook says, why don't we just take that principle and apply it to Bible study also? He said in another letter, we cannot deny, this is source 2, that there are many good things, even in books that are deficient in many places. He begrudgingly says, you know, they're deficient. These people don't believe a thing that we do. But you know what? There's a lot of good scholarship here. And truth is more beloved than all else. And it is specifically in that that God is to be praised and the banner of the believer's faith is raised. So he's fully honest with what's going on. He says, here are people who don't share traditional belief in the Torah, but a lot of these ideas are really good, or at least thought-provoking. We need to be provoked, rather than hiding from it. Now, the truth is, he's just espousing Rambam's view in the olden days, where he says, very bluntly, in his introduction to his commentary on the Pirkei Avot, in Source 3, hear the truth from whoever says it. Rambam was very much engaged in that world. Many of his best ideas aren't his ideas, and they aren't authentically Jewish ideas, although he believed that they were, right? He thought that the Greek philosophers had some great things going. Let's bring it in. Why in the world should we deprive ourselves of great ideas just because the person who said it wasn't Jewish? That's absurd. So Rambam was very much in that camp, and Rav Kook understood that this was something that needed to happen. Rav Kook's approach is the only one of the three approaches that emerged from the Orthodox world, which says that there is zero conflict ever between faith and science. Right? The first approach is that there is a conflict and therefore ignore science. The second approach is faith is scientific, which is not true, even though it's a nicer idea. And the third one is that faith and science are two different arenas and they interact with each other. Rav Kook inspired generations of students to start learning Bible with that principle. One of his key students in this saga was somebody named Rabbi Moshe Zeidel, who was a towering Bible scholar and a student of Rav Kook. And Rav Zeidel trained a whole generation of scholars back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, in the good old days from my perspective, but all the same, not that long ago, where they were going to integrate, following Rav Kook's mission, integrate in one comprehensive commentary on the Bible the best that tradition and the academy has to offer. And so they did. They set out in the 1950s, they were discussing what this commentary should be. In 1963, they began to say, okay, you're going to do Bereishit, and you're going to do Iyov, and so on and so forth. And this commentary went on from 1970, when the first volumes were published, until 2003, when the last volumes were published. And this is called the Dat Mikra set. It's the Dat Mikra commentary that was published in Israel from 1970 through 2003. There is simply nothing like that that ever had emerged from the Orthodox world to this degree before. And in fact, it's just a formidable commentary written by anybody, which is the point. It shouldn't be that the academy has better scholarship than the religious world. The religious world should be at the vanguard of great scholarship. And indeed, that's what they were trying to achieve with that. So that was one major achievement that occurred in the 20th century as a direct consequence of Rav Kook's vision. Another great accomplishment was just one person. Her name was Nechama Leibowitz. She changed the world for everybody on all sides of every fence. For the Orthodox world, she's the one who brought the tools of the academy and showed that these tools are better than the tools that we had been using a generation or two or thousands of years ago. What a great systematic way of approaching text and commentary that nobody had done before. So she just swoops in, took the world by storm, and, well, she was Nechama Leibowitz for one good reason, that. And all of a sudden, thousands and thousands of people who were never exposed to this methodology were not only exposed, but they were transformed by it. And then, for that matter, since she taught in universities in Israel, she taught the academic establishment. Traditional Jewish commentators have a lot to contribute to the modern experience also. It's not that you have this condescending thing of pre-modern or pre-critical, the way the critics used to speak. She said, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, all the others, they have a lot to say to this world. I remember once I gave a talk. It wasn't a talk. It was a panel discussion at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. It was supposed to be one Orthodox, one Conservative, and one Reform Rabbi, but somehow they counted wrong, so it was me and two Reform Rabbis. I don't know how they did that, but okay, but they did. And we had a panel discussion about the Noah story. So we gave our takes. It was a great discussion, lovely, lovely back and forth, all the good stuff that you would want to have at this sort of thing. And several people from the audience, the way the lighting was, I couldn't see any of the faces. It was just this blur, okay? So they could see us, I hope. But I couldn't see any. I had no idea who was there. My mom could have been there. I would have had no idea. She wasn't, because she probably would have come over and given me a kiss afterwards. But if she were there, I would have no idea. So afterwards, several people came over, no idea who they were, who all said the same thing. I never had any idea that medieval rabbis had something to say to us. And it just was that light bulb moment of, for me, medieval means Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, Rambam, for all of us here. Whereas to a university-educated person, that's more, medieval means dark ages. And then the history professors will tell you, don't use that term, blah, 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 fine. But it's definitely a different world for them than it was for where I was coming from. It was very meaningful. So Nechama Leibowitz is the one who let the academic establishment know how important it was to pay attention to the spectrum of interpretation. She really did a singular job. Nobody before or after has been able to integrate it to such a degree, and she had such a huge, huge, huge impact. There was one figure in Israel who was less known in America. I only finally figured him out a few years ago. I've been working on this for like a long time. I finally figured out what he's trying to do, so now I can talk about him, so that's helpful. His name was Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. Rabbi Breuer, when he started writing in 1959, 1960, several articles, nobody understood what he was talking about. But that didn't stop people from attacking him, because you know that that's what happens sometimes. So he would get up and talk about these things, and people would bombard him. And he kept on trying to clarify. Finally, he clarified it enough that regular people like me could start understanding what he's trying to do. And now the scholarly world has more of an interest in him than they did when nobody could figure out what he was doing. He was the first one to finally, in the Orthodox world, to finally ask, you know, the critics are right. We should be asking the question of, why are there so many contradictions? None of us are doing that. We're still so busy battling them. But the fact is, we can't solve every contradiction. There are many. So why are there so many anyway? He was the first one. It took 40 years of his writing to finally iron that out so I could summarize it in a meaningful and coherent way. But he finally straightened it out in his own writings because of all the attacks, and that's good for all of us. His major point was, truth is complex. I don't need to tell anybody in this room that. We deal with so many complex truths, not just in the realm of Torah, but in every realm. And God is revealing the Torah to people who bless us. Some of us are more finite than others, but all of us are quite finite. We can't understand divine truth. If God would have revealed the Torah with divine truth, even Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't understand, let alone regular folk like us or anybody else. And therefore, God had to simplify things for us people, even smart ones. The way that God did this is through aspects. God would reveal a part of a truth in one passage in the Torah, and a different part of the truth in a different passage. And to us, they seem to be contradictory, because we're people. We don't understand how God can have mutually exclusive things in one room. But as a result, we're able to understand the divine truth only by understanding each aspect first in and of itself. This was a game changer. And I'll give you an example so that it makes sense in real life. I don't need to tell anybody here that the first two chapters of Genesis, of Bereshit, sound very different. They're both talking about creation, but they have different stories to tell. And not only do they have different stories to tell in terms of emphasis, but the facts seem to not match. So, for example, in Genesis 1, it sounds like the people, man and woman, are created poof at the same time. Whereas in chapter 2, the man is single for quite some time until finally he gets a wife. In chapter 1, I thought the order was birds, then land animals, then people. But in chapter 2, it's people, and then birds and land animals are later. There are factual contradictions between them. So, for thousands of years, we went about harmonizing them and explaining how all of it is factually true, and this is what happened. And we had different approaches. The critics came along and said, no, it's just different authors. And this was one author's conception of creation, and here was a different author's conception of creation. So Rabbi Breuer, working with the premise that, the traditional Jewish premise, that God revealed the entire Torah, said, look, there are different parts of our relationship with God. In chapter 1, it's all about just objective nature and how we're part of nature. When it comes to objective nature and that we're part of nature, okay, so it was birds, then animals, then people. And people are created together because our goal is to procreate like all other animals. We might be more special, we're still created in God's image, but all the same, we're part of a natural order in chapter 1. In chapter 2, the whole theme is relationships. Our relationship with God and our relationship between ourselves. Suddenly, Adam has a need for a woman. And the relationship between man and woman is celebrated by the end of the chapter. Adam's relationship with God is celebrated in this chapter. It all has to do with his faithfulness to God's first commandment, namely, don't eat from that tree over there. Okay, so all of a sudden, when it comes to relationships, well, then Adam is going to be presented first because he's special. Birds and animals, whatever relationship they have with God, it's different. And therefore, they're downplayed. It all has to do with Adam and Eve and their relationship with one another and with God. So what happened? If you ask Rabbi Breuer, okay, fine. So who was created first, people or birds? Or Rabbi Breuer would say, that's a job left to the rabbis. Yes, we still, if you want to come up with the what happened, so work it out. And there are different approaches. But I'm interested, said Rabbi Breuer, in what is each aspect of the Torah trying to teach? What messages comes from each one? If you spend all your time reconciling, you lose that. At the same time, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik in The Lonely Man of Faith was doing this, but not in a systematic, sustained way. But he made the same point. He said he focuses on different aspects of people. Chapter 1 is all about the scientists that we all have within. Chapter 1 is how people are creative. They want to dominate the world. And chapter 2 is about our humanness as the philosopher. We want to know why things work the way that they do. We want to have a relationship with God. So he wasn't interested in resolving these contradictions. His conclusion, in fact, was, we're all made up of both of these elements, and therefore we have inner contradictions. And so the Torah is reflecting human reality. So rather than seeing contradictions as something that need to be swept under a rug, or pushed to the side, or solved, and then they're gone, he said, no, let's celebrate these contradictions. God wants these contradictions here because there are genuine existential conflicts and contradictions in life. So that's one dimension which has radically transformed Orthodox Bible scholarship in the 20th and 21st century. Rabbi Breuer's pioneering efforts, thank God, have been significantly refined. He did a great job for what he was trying to do. But that needed to be refined in a very serious way. That always happens with the pioneers. And a lot of the scholars in Yeshivat Haaretzion, their affiliate, Summit Yeshiva University, essentially have adopted this kind of approach of aspects, where the Torah is deliberately trying to teach complex truths through presenting different aspects of this truth in different places. And our job is not necessarily to fix the contradictions, and our job is not even to necessarily come up with what happened historically. That's simply not our agenda anymore. The agenda is, what message does each passage want to give and how that contributes to a divine truth. That's part A. Part B, and then I can do many parts for this kind of thing. Just get me started, and oh my, but I'd rather do one more example and then open it up to you so we can have a conversation about what's of interest to you as well. Two things that have also radically changed within the Orthodox world, within the sector of the Orthodox world, have to do with the ancient setting of the Torah, where there's a great nod of confidence to the Torah was not given in a bubble. Yes, we might have been in a desert, but that desert was surrounded by many nations, and Israel had to interact with these many nations, and the Torah interacts with these many nations as well. And similarly, the literary setting of the Torah is very significant. Words matter. And how the Torah presents its story is way more important than the fact behind the story. It's built on history. But what matters much more is what words is the Torah using in order to convey these messages. This matters to any religious person who takes the Torah seriously, because we're not interested in the history as much as we're interested in what does God want of us, whether in law or whether in morality. Example. So I sit down with my six-year-old daughters. We have twins. We're blessed with twins. And we call it parasha. What it means is they're starting to get this now that they're six. So we're actually just marching through all the Tanakh. We've gone through it three times in the last couple of years so far. So now we're in round four. And we just recently got up to the story where Jacob puts on goat fuzz to deceive his father and obtain Esau's blessings. With his mother's blessings. Rivka, Rebecca, told him to go do that. He did it. Okay. So as they get older, now in comes the moral question. Because I'm not the type of guy who's going to say Esav was evil and murderous and terrible and Yaakov was wonderful and saintly and fabulous. Because that's a much later conception of these characters. If you read the stories, Esav is not all bad and Yaakov is not all good. Okay, so once you know that it's gray, what are we supposed to learn from this story? Was this deception valid? Was this a legitimate means of obtaining a blessing that belonged to Jacob? Or is this an illegitimate, wrongful mode of taking a blessing, in which case it's immoral, and we should learn something from that? What is the Torah trying to teach? In the medieval period, this question got clouded by Christian polemics in a very big way, unfortunately. Right, Christians were not always treating Jews so well back then. And one of the classic accusations was, you Jews today are as deceitful as your ancestor. Look, he's going and stealing the blessing via lies. So Jewish interpreters had no choice but in their commentaries but to react to this, because after all, Jews were very beleaguered in a very physical way. It wasn't just an intellectual debate. Many said what Jacob did was of course justified, and others said, no, we're still suffering as a consequence of this deception, quoting what was happening in medieval Christian Europe. So these debates are historically fascinating, but they might not inform our desire to learn, well, what does the Torah teach? That's more interesting in terms of the sorry medieval chapter of rabbis trying to cope with terrible persecution and oppression. So if you look from the text inward, and then outward again, well, here are the dimensions that I think are actually in the Torah, and then the firestorm of debate breaks out in the 20th and 21st centuries. Part of it is, look, Jacob wins, and he becomes the founder of our people, and God seems to like him. That matters. Okay, there's another piece of the puzzle. That Esav demonstrates that he's unworthy of the blessings, not because he's as wicked as what I learned when I was five, right? But because he marries Canaanites and his parents are heartbroken over that, because he sells the birthright and then doesn't tell his father about that at the key moment, clearly he's not meant to be a beloved figure, even if he's not nearly as bad as the way that he's often painted. The question now is that the whole story? Given that those details seem to be true, is that the whole story? So you have one camp that say, what we need to do is to appeal to the ancient setting. Here's the 21st century version of these medieval debates without the anti-Christian polemic, because we don't need, thank God, that's not our problem today. We have other challenges that are much stronger and pressing. One approach is that scholars will point out that in many ancient cultures, deceiving the more powerful one was a premium good thing. People respected that. If you could obtain what you wanted from a more powerful person by tricking them, that means that you're impressive. Many ancient cultures celebrated that as a virtue, whether or not you and I do. So some scholars say, well, the Torah is therefore celebrating how Jacob and Rebekah, who were the powerless ones, were able to trick the powerful Isaac, the patriarch of the family, and obtain the blessing that they wanted. And several great commentators today go that route. They say that that's what it's all about. We don't appreciate the Torah's setting, but once we do, okay, we realize the Torah is celebrating this deception. Nachama Leibowitz was the one who was most vocal against this approach. He said, are you kidding me? Just because other cultures celebrated deception doesn't mean that the Torah does. Maybe the Torah thinks deception is bad. Why do I think, says Nachama Leibowitz, that deception is bad? Because what does Jacob encounter for the whole rest of his life? The answer is a whole series of being deceived. So rather than the Torah just moralizing, because the Torah seldom moralizes, which makes it so much more fun for us, right? Because we can interpret. But the Torah doesn't say, this was bad in God's eyes. There are so few stories in the Torah that are like that. But how does the Torah say, this was bad in God's eyes? Father-in-law Lavan deceives Jacob by putting Leah in the bedroom instead of Rachel. Terrible. And I try telling that to six-year-olds. It's a horrible story. It's wrenching to think about the humanness of what's going on in that story, but it's terrible. The fact that later on Jacob's own sons deceive Jacob by pretending that Joseph is dead by using a goat. Okay, how can you miss that, says Nachama Leibowitz? How can you just say that people celebrate deception just because other cultures did when the Torah is saying Jacob is going to be a miserable man being through a sequence of deceit? There are other acts that could be brought in, but those are definitely the top two. So she would argue that the Torah is saying this deception was not a legitimate means to obtain a legitimate ends. She agrees that Jacob is the right successor for Isaac, not Esau, but this was not done the right way. She thinks that the Torah is moralizing against the deception. And then just to give you a more 21st century approach to the same inyan, the same issue, Rabbi Yonatan Grossman, who teaches at Yeshivat Har Etzion and also at Bar Ilan University, he talks about it in terms of dynamic boundaries. He says that Torah sometimes will, what literary scholars try to do is try to define what are the boundaries of a unit, because then we can try to understand what are the messages of this literary unit. He says in this case and in other cases in the Torah uses what's called dynamic boundaries. And what that means is the Torah deliberately has different ways you could break up the unit because it's a complicated story, like this one. So he says, if you just read the way that Stephen Langton, who's the Christian scholar in the 11th, 12th centuries, he's the one who broke the Torah and the whole Bible up into chapter numbers that we see in our printed texts. The medieval Christian man. Very good scholar, to be sure. But it was his interpretation of how to decide that this was chapter 27. So he made chapter 27 the deceit of Isaac. Right, if you just look in your Torahs and see what's in our printed text as chapter 27, Rebekah and Jacob look terrible. Because if you just read that story in a vacuum, poor, blind, old Isaac loves his son Esau, and sneaky wife and sneaky sons do the whole goat thing. It works. And then poor Esau is crying and he feels like he can't even get a blessing at all. You just want to jump into the text and give Esau a hug. And you're like, ugh, what a terrible thing they have done. The way that Stephen Langton broke up chapter 27, which has literary merit, Rebekah and Jacob look negative. They're the deceivers, but in a bad way. He says that's one way of breaking up a story. Another way of creating the unit is to say that it starts in, okay, I think we have some source sheets to do this. If you look at source 6, right before chapter 27 is chapter 26. The last couple of verses that you have there, Vayhi Esav ben arba'im shana, vayikach isha et Yehudit, bat be'eri achiti et basamat, bat elon achiti, vatiyena morat ruach liyitzchak ulrivka. Esav married Canaanites, which broke his parents' hearts. And the very next verse is that, and Yitzchak was blind, and da 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 da. So you understand that Yitzchak looks terrible for wanting to bless Esav after he knows that Esav broke the one family rule. They didn't have a lot of rules back then, but one of them was never ever marry Canaanites. They're really bad people. Don't have a family where there's going to be immorality in the home. Whatever other reasons they had against Canaanites. So if you start the story there and then you look at the end of the unit in source 8, sorry, not source 7, after Jacob runs off to Aram to marry what becomes Rachel and Leah, Esav realizes he did something bad. He feels bad that he married Canaanites, so he marries the daughter of Yishmael. So from this point of view, the unit is started. Esav marries Canaanites, and at the end he feels bad that he married Canaanites. And Jacob is going off to Aram to marry non-Canaanites. That's the story now. From that perspective, Esav is unworthy in this unit. He never deserved to have the birthright. He was a failure. And Isaac is a failure, by wanting to bless Esav, knowing that Esav is an unfit successor. From that point of view, Rebekah and Jacob are doing what needs to be done. And that's a second dimension. And then there's a third dimension. If you read the whole parasha that we call Toledot, okay, so now Rebekah has a prophecy all of a sudden, V'rav yavod tzair, that the elder shall serve the younger. And we now know that Jacob bought the birthright and Esav willingly sold the birthright. Well, if you know that, once again, Esav's legitimacy becomes even smaller and Jacob's legitimacy becomes even greater. And once again, that sets him up for being the right one in this story. Yonatan Grossman argues that that's the point of dynamic boundaries. The Torah is not forcing us to choose between these three ways of reading the story. It's a complicated story. Jacob is the worthy successor and Esav is unworthy. At the same time, the Torah has something very negative about deception. It doesn't say, oh, when you deceive powerful people, that's a good thing. The Torah has a problem with it. So Jacob suffers for the rest of his life, but at the same time, he was the legitimate heir of the blessings. It ends up giving you a much more complex, nuanced understanding of the entire passage by looking at it in multiple passages. One could go on, but just to wrap up my presentation, and then I'll turn it over to you until they make me sit down. And that's, and by the way, I know I do have my watch here, and unlike all those jokes about what rabbis do when they have their watches on the desk, I actually listen to that. I believe in start on time, end on time. It's very important, I think, especially when there are a lot of things that need to get done this morning. The point of the literary theological school is that God's revealed word continues to be God's revealed word, what it always has been. But every drop of the literary, which includes the historical setting and the literary reading of the text, are of primary importance to understand God's word. And from that point of view, every single thing that comes out of the academy is potentially valuable. Not everything that comes out of academies is valuable. I don't need to tell you that. But everything is potentially valuable. Every fact, every new discovery that they make, every new methodology that comes out of there, and perhaps most importantly, every question. What I always find most important about reading academic studies, or for that matter, anybody who doesn't share my beliefs, is that it forces me to ask myself, how much of what I thought before I read this piece is because I'm right and this guy is wrong? And how much of it is because I'm assuming tons and tons and tons of things beyond the text? Often enough, it's B. Often enough, it's, oh, I was taught something or I was assuming this or that, but who says that I'm right? Who says that this assumption is any better than that person's assumption? That's something that I find incredibly engaging and something incredibly valuable about being able to interact both with the world of tradition and at the same time with the world of the academy. And that's what the literary theological school is trying to do. And thank God it has flourished dramatically in the last 30, 40 years. It has a journal, Megadim, in Israel that was founded by these people. And more and more and more is winning the hearts not only in Israel, but it's making much greater waves in America as well. On that happy note, I end my presentation without jumping in and succumbing to my own Yetzer Hara to give you five more examples, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Yeah. I have a question regarding the contradictions. What's become very popular, especially in the last 40 years within the Orthodox community, is the concept of natural revelation. The idea is that transmitting the Torah over through natural revelation should resolve, shows the legitimacy of the Torah, and thus the basic foundation there needs to be solving these contradictions. How does this sort of theory of natural revelation flow into the idea of interpretation of contradiction?
Right, so national revelation is a very important thing. We're the only people in history that claim that God revealed himself to the entire nation as opposed to individuals. That's pretty cool. But that's hardly a proof, the way that some people use it in the veracity of the Torah. I don't need to tell you, just read Tanakh. You will see there were serious ruptures within the biblical period where most people were not faithful. Right? So to use this as a proof to demonstrate scientifically that our faith in fact is correct is, to me, a mistaken effort. So I just don't agree with it. In other words, my faith isn't rooted in the fact that I could prove it scientifically. It's a very personal thing. So that's all. So in other words, I still deal with contradictions because I treat it as God's word, and now I want to understand what does the Torah mean. So that's why I think Rabbi Breuer's approach is very, very rewarding. Yeah.
You spoke about contradictions within the text, but what about contradictions between science and the text? For example, you know, the whole idea that this universe is billions of years old versus 5,777 years old. How does this school deal with that?
Yeah, so thank God this question, your question is, of course, not only valid, it's critical, and I wish that this were a no-brainer in all Orthodox circles by now, but it's not, but I'm working on it. But it's going to take some time. This problem was addressed already in the medieval period. This isn't the new thing. That's why I'm not talking about it today. In other words, this is what Rav Sadia Gaon and Rambam and others were saying a long, long time ago. So when I give courses about the interaction between tradition and contemporary academic, I'm focusing much more on literary critical issues. But I always have one shiur on science, just to make sure that they're aware at Yeshiva University that this isn't a new problem, although people continue to view it as a problem sometimes. I don't know why. The Rambam's approach is always God made both. God wrote the Torah and God made nature. So they can't really contradict. So if there seem to be contradictions, we don't understand something properly because we're limited as humans. In the case of any science versus Torah phenomenon, if science can be empirically demonstrated, then it's true. And that means that we're not supposed to understand the Torah as a science book. That's all. It's really a very straightforward thing. So my brother-in-law, who's a geneticist at Hopkins, will always point out to me that he wants to use the word impossible, but he's a good scientist. So he'll say, I can't use the word impossible, but what's the likelihood genetically that all of us are really related from a couple that lived 6,000 years ago? From his point of view, that's impossible, but he's not allowed to use that word, right? So I say, look, what difference does it make? Let's say you prove conclusively that we're not. I'm not going to become a racist as a result. The Torah is trying to teach us that we mustn't be racists, that we're all family, all humanity is family. That's what the Torah is trying to get to me. If you tell me that science has a different way of explaining the origins of humanity, I fully accept that. But the Torah doesn't in any way lose its oomph in terms of what it's actually doing. I would just tell you, okay, if you're right, then we're not all descendants, biological descendants of one couple that lived 6,000 years ago. That's cool. Yeah. All the way in the back. Yeah.
I love the idea you're talking about, Rabbi Mordechai is a
Breuer. Breuer, yeah.
Predictions are meant to surface different psychological or emotional, just human realities. I was wondering if you could give us a couple more examples of places where, you know, someone who's trying to, like, gotcha the Torah would say, aha, there's a contradiction, but actually there's something beautiful, psychological, emotional, human, that, you know, they, just like you did, actually, with the Adam and Eve example.
Okay, so the question is, what can I do offhand and short? So let's see what I can do. Okay, in the flood narrative, there are also contradictions. For example, the only real contradiction is how many cows, or bovines, right? How many bovines did Noah bring onto the ark? If you read certain passages of the Torah, the answer is two, like any other animal. I learned as a kid two by two, but that just means two turtles and two rhinos. It doesn't mean four, two male, two female, right? It's one male, one female. Perpetuation of the species. So too with the bovines. And then there's another passage in the Torah, in the flood story, that says you have to take seven pairs of what you and I call the kosher animals, which are already acknowledged in that terminology in the Torah. Bemoto wrote, the clean animals. All right, so once again, the critics would just say these are two different sources that are woven together, but they originally disagreed, and that's why there is a contradiction. So Rabbi Elchanan Samet, one of the leading proponents of this method, he argues that God actually saves humanity for two different reasons. In the Noah story, there are two facets or two aspects of this. One facet is, or aspect, Noah deserves to be saved because he is righteous, because he has a relationship with God. That's the one that I think if you ask most kids, that's what they would answer, and that's part of what the Torah teaches. From Noah's relationship with God point of view, he is saved because he is righteous. God tells him as much, and God says, bring 14 bovines because you're going to end up sacrificing a bunch of them at the end, and you and I still want to have some bovines around after that. So that's why Noah needed additional, what we call kosher animals. Then there's another layer that often is ignored, where God saved Noah and his family because God had to save somebody. God had a covenant with the world to perpetuate humanity and its species. So God may have saved Noah because Noah was the most righteous, but he had to save somebody. There never was an option in the Torah's framework of God will flood out all the people and then just make a new world, which he could have done. That's an alternative. So from that point of view, also, you have a good example of a factual contradiction in play. But rather than trying to solve it, say that this deals with two dimensions. One is the objective God-creation relationship, where God wants to preserve humanity. And the other one is God saved Noah because Noah deserved to be saved. So that's a little example that's quick, which is why I did that. But this is really a whole complex, by the way, not only a narrative, but it affects law also. The rabbis were well aware that there are many legal contradictions in the Torah. So when it comes to, okay, so what should we do? That's why you need the rabbinic layer and the oral law to be able to interpret on a practical level what we do. So it's really minute by minute you will find many such contradictions. Okay, yes?
You mentioned that this way of doing things is different than what was ever done before. As you're saying this, it doesn't sound so different from what the rabbis of the Talmud and the rabbis did, finding two things we learned from these two different examples. Can you say a little bit more about how this may be similar or different from that?
You're absolutely right, just to reiterate the question. It doesn't seem so different after all. To some degree, you're always right. Any traditionalist will always invoke precedents of the past, right? They don't want to break new ground. Rabbi Breuer would be the last one to want to be a pioneer. His whole point is, this is what our tradition always teaches, and to some degree, and that's what he insisted exactly what you say. But look, the rabbis also are trying to find multiple lessons that can emerge from different texts. That's for sure true. The difference between what Rabbi Breuer did and what before him did is that Rabbi Breuer is doing this in a systematic theory way. Rabbis always did it piecemeal. Here's a contradiction, let's fix it, or let's even derive different lessons, right? But they never had a systematic approach to why are there so many contradictions, and can we give a global theory? That's something that when I tell my students, it's a funny thing to say in an Orthodox yeshiva, yeshiva university, we owe a thank you note to Spinoza for that one. Right? Without him, we would still be doing, sometimes I give shiurim of this variety, I try to say, here's how I would have given this class in 1605, I just made up a number, it's not specific to 1605, and here's how I would give it now. Sometimes it's basically the same, or at least similar, and sometimes it's wildly different because we've been asking different questions, and it's important just to have a consciousness of what different generations have contributed to a global discussion, which you're right, it's not out of nowhere. But the systematic approach to these issues is one that really came from the academic world much more than from the classic Orthodox rabbinic world of yore. Yeah.
I think the problem that I sometimes have, and I assume my colleagues do as well, is invoking God's name to this particular text when there's an impulse in all of creation to try to define how we got here with creation stories that are perhaps maybe dated even earlier than those who were both scientifically dated the narrative in Genesis. So it's always hard to attribute divinity in dealing with these episodes. So how do you reconcile this? Because it remains problematic in my young age.
It's not only a fair question, I think it's a very important one. The history of this issue of how to deal with the Torah as a divine document when it's interacting with documents that are, we would agree just as quickly, are much older in many cases, and there seems to be a lot of resemblance, at least in certain instances, not all the time. So there was actually a history of this. The first wave of archaeological scholarship in the olden days was aiming, the scholars there were trying to prove the truth of the Bible. That was their agenda. It was a very clear agenda. I might be sympathetic to that to some degree, but it's actually terrible scholarship, right? In other words, there shouldn't be that kind of agenda. Try to interpret archaeological data on their own right and then interpret the Torah on its own right and see how they interface. That's better scholarship, right? That was the first wave. The second wave came along and asked your question, which is a venerable question. It's been going on for a couple hundred years, which is, wait a minute, if all these ancient cultures have similar things, maybe the Torah is just a knockoff, and a cheap knockoff at that, of the earlier stories and laws and so on and so forth. It's just part of an ancient Near Eastern development thing, right? And that's where the God piece is threatened in this saga, right? The third wave, which is not just in the Orthodox world, this was, you know, Umberto Casuto and Yechezkel Koifman, Moshe Greenberg, Nachum Sarna, who were very religious people, the last two, but they weren't in the Orthodox world, but they were very deeply religious people by any stretch. I love reading them and I love quoting them. But they realized from varying perspectives that the Torah is vastly superior to the surrounding culture, and they could even show how the Torah borrows forms of the pagan world while changing the content on a fundamental level. Now, that doesn't prove that God wrote it, right? There's no scientific, empirical way to demonstrate God did or God didn't. But the way that anybody in this school would talk about it would say God specifically knew the world that the Israelites were going to live in and therefore spoke their language and gave a vast improvement over anything that was out there then. So that's what contemporary scholarship does a lot, independent of the Orthodox literary theological school. They realize that Torah is something in form that's very similar in many ways to ancient literatures and legal codes, but in content it is vastly different. Well, the best model of that was Yechezkel Koifman, who probably was the least religious of the four names that I mentioned a moment ago. But he understood. He was just an empirical scholar. He just said, here are the different texts, here's what the Torah is doing that's different from all of those texts in a systematic, sustained way. And so I think that that's where the fruitful avenue of research goes. And again, this doesn't prove disprove. It just means that this is how a person of faith deals with these issues in terms of, it's good to know that the Torah is improving upon something that is there, or in some cases, as Rav Kook pointed out, sometimes just adopting what the ancient world was doing, because sometimes the ancient world got it right. They had many moral laws that we think are moral also. There's no reason why the Torah couldn't adopt them and even use similar formulations to get that point across. Yeah.
So my question is, are there halachic implications to this approach?
Excellent question, and a very important one, to be perfectly honest. This question honestly goes back to the 12th century also, when the rabbis were busy fighting about this very issue. The issue in play was pshat. This is the way I define it, and it's based on, you know, there's many different ways to talk about it. Pshat is the primary original intent of the author. At least that's what all of our commentators are trying to get when they go for pshat. So in legal texts, in verses in the Torah that have laws, pshat should be God's original intent, original primary intent. So that, for example, should be the law. Now the question is, what if the sages in the Talmud say something that really didn't sound like what you can read when you look at the Torah text? Okay, so there's two schools of thought about how to deal with seeming gaps between those two worlds. One is to insist the sages must have a received tradition that this is what the verse really means. But the verse certainly means what the sages say. So eye for an eye, you might think it means poke the guy's eyeball out, but it doesn't. It means monetary compensation. That's it. Okay, that's one approach. And that, of course, keeps it clean, right? And it's certainly simpler. The other approach, which Rashbam was a champion of and Ramban picked up later on, was that there can be an independent pshat meaning of a verse that God intended, but the law is what the oral law says it is, the applied law. So if Rashbam can say that God created the world and day came before the night, which is what he thinks, that doesn't take away from the fact that he started Shabbat on Friday night like the rest of us. Because the law trumps our functional, how we actually observe the laws. Right? So plugging that into the 21st century. So when there are Rabbi Breuer and those who follow his school, when they're trying to learn pshat in the halachic verses of the Torah, nobody will ever walk away with, and therefore we should observe Judaism differently. What they're going to say is, here is the primary layer of pshat in the Torah itself, but the oral law is where the buck stops when it comes to law. So that's simply following in the premise of Rashbam and Ramban. That school has won as far as this school is concerned. So no, there are no legal changes that would come. In other words, if you really buckled down and you were utterly convinced that eye for an eye means you poke the guy's eye out, you still, as a dayan, if you were in a court that actually had the authority to do that sort of thing, would still impose monetary compensation. You would never change the law to what you think the verse means.
So you don't apply this approach to the halakhic world?
Correct. The halakhic world, in other words, has a life of its own that stands independent of the pshat school. That's the whole Rashbam and Ramban premise, and again, that's what this school is doing as well. They're not relearning halacha. Yes? Even rabbis typically sit in the back row, but I'm always impressed that a few sit in the front row. Anyway, yeah. There's always a penalty for people who come late. That's what I always say, but yeah.
Where's the measure?
It fits. But different people within the school have different approaches. In other words, halachic midrashim play a central role, as we were just talking about. Agadic midrashim have always been debated over what role should they play. That's not a modern question. I happen to think that the rabbinic sages have so much to offer us that I can't imagine ignoring them. It's like they have so much to offer both in terms of their own meanings that they're trying to create, but also meanings of the Torah. They really send you rethinking, like, what do they see here that might be relevant? And often enough, they see something that is there that you might have missed. So, but that's the slogan that I always bandy around, and I learned it from somebody. I didn't make it up. Is one person's pshat is another person's drash. In other words, when you give your interpretation of something, you might think this is really what the Torah means, and the person next to you might think, you're making this up, it's your own meaning, but it has nothing to do with what the Torah means. We've been debating that for thousands of years. So Midrashei Agadah, those Midrashim that don't have legal consequence, have always been that funny bird in terms of they should be learned because they're part of our tradition, and they have meaning because they have good things to say, but there's always going to be a debate over how much of that is what the Torah itself means. Yes?
I appreciate the resource at the end in terms of individuals using the school. I'm just curious about somebody like Oriel Seymour. Would he be considered part of the school?
There's a lot of... I try hard not to put people into boxes, just in general. The people who I mentioned for further study, just so that you can get a good sense of it, are the leading lights of what I think of in a narrow sense as the literary theological school. There are plenty of scholars of all stripes, not just Uriel Simon. Uriel Simon is an observant Jew, right? People who are not observant Jews, who also are still doing work that is quite central to what this enterprise is all about. Uriel Simon would call himself an academic. I mean, that's what he was. And he's not speaking as a rabbi who's specifically trying to gain religious meaning from the text itself. But he's a religious Jew. He obviously did use his scholarship to inform his personal observance and his religious encounter with God. But he's not writing as a rabbinic thinker. When I say rabbi, it doesn't have to be somebody with ordination. I mean somebody who's working within the premise that the reason why you come to the text of the Torah is to encounter God. So in the academic world, you might be doing that, but you're not allowed to say that. Right? You have to hide that part from your scholarship because academic scholarship is supposed to keep God at the door. But you might personally be very religious, like somebody like Uriel Simon. Yes?
One last question. Okay. You're getting on where I'm trying to get back to the God issue.
The God issue, yeah. Okay?
What you've really been trying to demonstrate is that despite or maybe even because of the contradictions, inconsistencies, parallels, etc., the Torah still has much to teach us, and that's the question we should be asking when it comes to Torah. What is it trying to say to us? And my question is, how does that differ from what many non-Orthodox scholars have been doing in the 20th century? And going back to the issue of the God's relationship to that, it's one thing to say that the Torah is teaching us X. It's another thing to say that this is the Word of God. When you say this is the Word of God, what do you mean by that?
Right, so that's probably a hard thing to answer in the 20 seconds that I have before Rabbi Belinsky says it's time for our break. But that's the big question. Without trying to define it...
God's intervention.
Yes, save by the break. Look, to define revelation at all, you need to be one of the leading theologians of whatever stripe you wish to be, to really sit down and try to pin down what it means. But I think any traditional thinker would say, you sees it when you knows it. Without getting too specific about how God revealed himself to Moses, you can say that God revealed the Torah, and somehow Moses was able to produce the text based on that. Right? So that's what traditional Jewish belief always was. To say, therefore, the Torah cannot have meaning in any other way is, of course, not true. I don't need to tell you or anybody in this room or any room otherwise. People who don't believe in anything, you know, I can end on this point. There's somebody named William Propp who wrote the Anchor Bible commentary on Exodus. Anchor Bible is a secular academic commentary written by people of different faiths, some more religious, some less religious. He writes that he's an atheist. And I'm thinking, isn't this so cool that you have somebody, he doesn't not believe in Torah min ha-shamayim, that God revealed the Torah. He doesn't even believe in Shamayim, right? And yet he's dedicating his life to Torah. He's written a fabulous commentary just on the book of Shemot. So that to me is, you're right, one cannot have a traditional Jewish belief and find great meaning in the Torah, but the traditional Jewish belief is that this actually is God's word, however one wishes to define that in theological terms. So that's what this school is focused on. This school says there never needs to be a threat from any scholarship. To the contrary, scholarship is always good because, as the Talmud says better than anybody, God's seal is truth. We should be pursuing truth as well. The God part is what matters the most, but tradition definitely said that it's at least largely to Moses as well. And then again, today there's all kinds of nuance and sophistication. That's another talk, which is an interesting talk, but not today's talk. On that happy note, I thank you all so much. Enjoy your break. I'll turn it over to Rabbi Belinsky, who will give you the logistics from this moment on.